Okay, up next, Linda Moulton Howe with us with some incredible stories, and we're going to begin talking about the Zika virus. She's got an update for us, but there's some other incredible stories throughout the night that she will be reporting on. So we'll be back with Linda in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I got lots of emails last month from people wondering, where the heck is Linda Moulton Howe? Well, as I mentioned, that she was off on a wedding. No, not hers, but her daughter. How did that go, Linda?
Oh, it was so glorious and happy that it is sometimes in life you go through a month where everything is so sparkling and so perfect that all the problems in the world just kind of fade away, and so do UFOs and ETs. But we had a wonderful time, and I have come back to an office just flooded.
Ready to go.
New reports, and tonight I want to start in an update on the Zika virus, which is turning out to be more serious than people thought some time ago. The 2016 Olympic Summer Games, in fact, started off with that worry.
Oh, sure did.
Now they are over, but the worries about rapidly spreading Zika virus infections from Brazil throughout the Americas, including the United States, are growing. For the past few months, we have heard about the Zika virus causing the small damaged brain syndrome known as microcephaly in pregnant women. The virus gets into people from mosquito bites. Zika can travel from its puncture into human flesh to a pregnant woman's placenta and move right through blood into developing fetuses. Microcephaly cases in Brazil, the rest of South America, Central America, Mexico, Haiti, and Puerto Rico are now estimated to be in the thousands. Puerto Rico alone has over 13,000 confirmed Zika infections, and some have caused microcephaly. But now adults are also suffering nerve damage. There are 34 Puerto Rico adults with Zika infections have developed Guillain-Barré syndrome, which causes weak muscles and it can paralyze. In fact, two Puerto Rican men so far have died from Guillain-Barré paralysis, one in August and one in April. This means that Zika is not only attacking and destroying developing fetal brain cells, but it can damage brain tissues in adult men and women. Since its first discovery in monkeys living in the Zika forest of Uganda in 1947, the Zika virus was not known to mutate. In 60 years, from 1947 to 2007, only 14 cases of Zika infection in humans had been reported. Small outbreaks in Africa and later in Southeast Asia were mild with a rash that soon went away, and Zika was never associated with birth defects or adult paralysis. But by 2007 to 2008, something began changing in the Zika virus when there was a large outbreak in Yap, Micronesia, and a U.S. scientist working in Senegal was infected with Zika, returned home to Colorado, and infected his wife in what is probably the first documented case of sexual transmission from human sperm. There are 3,500 species of mosquitoes on Earth, and at least two are the biggest known carriers of this increasingly dangerous Zika virus. They are Aedes aegypti, that lives in 24 states from Connecticut to Florida, across the southern tier to California. On August 16th, New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich announced the creation of a Zika resource center because four cases of Zika have been in New Mexico, where the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes live and have already been confirmed in people who traveled. A second mosquito carrier of Zika are the Aedes albopictus, which bite animals and birds in addition to humans. This mosquito's range is even bigger through the entire eastern half of the United States, plus New Mexico, Arizona, and California. And a third possible mosquito carrier of the Zika virus is Culex pipion, and it is found everywhere in the United States. One scientist at Penn State in University Park, Pennsylvania, likes to study mosquitoes, and this month was awarded a two-year grant from the National Institutes of Health to search for Zika virus in mosquito guts and salivary glands that can enter humans through bites. He is Jason Razgon, PhD, Associate Professor of Entomology and Disease Epidemiology. And here he is from Penn State, Pennsylvania.
This outbreak was very different from everything that's happened in the previous 60 years. It was much larger, and it's still going on, obviously. And for the first time, we were seeing Zika virus infection being associated with Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an autoimmune disorder that's triggered by an infection, which causes paralysis. And there's no real treatment for it. It goes away, but if you don't get to a hospital, paralyze your breathing apparatus, and you can't breathe and you die.
Professor Razgon, let me make sure I understand. Suddenly, in 2015, centered around Salvador, Brazil, Zika is spreading to adults and causing the Guillain-Barré syndrome of paralysis in adults.
Yeah, and then we saw the fetal birth defects, the microcephaly and everything else. That's never been seen before. So definitely, I think it's 100% clear that Zika is associated and is a factor in newborn microcephaly and neurological birth defects. What is not clear is Zika the only thing responsible, because the data here are very new. When you look at the outbreak that's happening in Colombia right now, we're not seeing newborn microcephaly, not nearly to the extent that we're seeing it in Brazil. So there could be other confounding factors where the Zika virus infection is one of the factors, but it has to be in conjunction with something else. And what that something else is, we don't really understand yet.
What do you think has changed suddenly between Yap and Salvador, Brazil, and now spreading to Colombia, the United States, and perhaps around the world?
So it could be the birth defects that we're seeing now that we didn't see then. The first explanation is that the Zika virus mutated. Now it's causing problems. So there has been some data that suggests the virus is genetically different. Another explanation is the size of the outbreak. So all of a sudden you have 1 million people infected. You're seeing those negative outcomes occurring.
How many women right now have been identified in Brazil, Colombia, who have had births with microencephaly?
Going to be thousands. If Zika was not causing fetal birth defects, even if this outbreak was huge the way it is, nobody would care. Males should be concerned because if they're infected, they can transmit the virus sexually to their partner. Then you would potentially see the complications with fetal birth defects.
But what is so insidious now about the Zika virus is that the transmission can be through sexual intercourse before either partner knows what has happened. And then if there is a pregnancy, there is a likelihood, based on the Brazil data, that there could be microencephaly, the small head syndrome, and brain damage.
Yeah, Zika, about 4 out of 5 people that get it don't have any symptoms. That doesn't mean that it's not having an effect on the fetus.
Yeah.
The sexual transmission thing is very interesting because we haven't really seen that before.
When is the woman with a developing fetus the most vulnerable to getting the microencephaly in the fetus?
What we know now, the earlier that a woman gets infected, the worse it's going to potentially be for the fetus. But there have been documented cases where infection at any stage in the pregnancy can be harmful. And particularly if a woman gets infected before she knows that she's actually pregnant, the first trimester seems to be the case where the worst fetal birth defects are seen. And that makes sense because that's when the nervous system is actually beginning to develop.
And this is a virus that is attacking the nervous system in the developing fetus?
Yes.
Any idea at this point why that would be from the Zika virus?
I have no idea. I don't know epidemiologically and I don't know molecularly. There are people who are trying to work that out. But there have been studies to show that growing balls of brain cells in a dish, the virus seems to have unusual tropism for the fetal nervous tissue cells. And it can also cross the placenta. So it can go from the mother to the fetus.
That's unusual in and of itself, isn't it?
I think it's relatively unusual, yeah.
What are you now going to do in your research at Penn State?
I'm interested in looking at, particularly for North America, what mosquitoes are competent to transmit the virus. So we already know that Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus are competent to transmit. those are considered to be the vectors that are responsible for transmitting Zika virus. When people are talking about the risk of Zika introduction into the United States, all of the estimates of risk are based on the assumption that Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus are the only mosquitoes that can actually transmit Zika virus. We don't actually know. So if some other mosquito in the U.S., such as Culex or something else, is competent to transmit virus, then everything that we're saying about the risk of introduction needs to be reevaluated.
When you say competent to transmit, can you explain what that means?
Yeah. So we take the mosquitoes in the laboratory, and we have an artificial blood feeder that we spike with a Zika virus. And then we assess, can the virus infect the mosquito gut? Can it get out of the mosquito gut and infect the other mosquito tissues? And then can it infect the mosquito salivary glands and be secreted into the saliva and be secreted by a mosquito when it's spiking? So we are looking for infectious virus in the mosquito saliva. If we can find that, then we say, yes, this mosquito is competent to transmit Zika virus.
How many species of mosquitoes are there around the world?
There's about 3,500 species of mosquitoes.
And if all of them ended up being able to transmit the Zika virus, we could have a really serious global problem when it comes to pregnancies.
Zika has actually been isolated from mosquitoes in the field from 26 different species of mosquitoes. Now, just because you isolate virus from a mosquito in the wild does not mean it transmits it, you know, because you can have the virus that's able to infect the mosquito gut, but it never gets out of the gut. Can't get to the salivary gland, the mosquito can't transmit. That suggests the possibility that more than these two species are capable. So it's not going to be all of them, but you know, even if just one other, say, Culex pipien, which is a widespread mosquito, or Culex twincafasciatus, the potential range of Zika risk is going to be greatly expanded. We're not talking about all mosquitoes, but it doesn't have to be all mosquitoes. It's just another couple ones, depending on what they are, could have a large effect on our estimates of risk.
Have you talked with somebody at a political government level now, as somebody who knows a great deal about mosquitoes, that this could become a kind of pandemic?
Yeah, I don't like to throw around words like pandemic. We have viruses and things that are transmitted by the West Nile, which is moved around the world. I've talked to some of the state governmental officials here in Pennsylvania, and they came and asked me. Then we have to talk about the behavior of the mosquito. You can have mosquitoes that are biologically competent to transmit a pathogen, but they don't feed on people. They only feed on cows or birds or whatever. Aedes aegypti is a better vector because it only really feeds on people. The Zika virus can only replicate in people. The Aedes aegypti feeds only on people, so the transmission efficiency is kind of amplified. If a pregnant woman is infected, there's nothing she can do to protect her fetus at that point. So whatever's going to happen is going to happen.
Right. And right now, the worst case is that we didn't know enough in the last 2 months to protect people who have become pregnant, not just in Brazil.
Yeah, everywhere. Puerto Rico's been having a raging outbreak since February. They've had 1,500 cases. They've had about almost 200 pregnant women that have been infected. Nobody cares about Puerto Rico. They only start caring when 14 people get infected in Florida.
And Brazil, talk about how big the problem is in Brazil and South America.
Millions of cases.
Millions?
Yeah, millions. It's a huge outbreak.
Are we now talking about the possibility that whatever is happening with the Zika virus is ready to spring in other parts of the world?
I don't know. I look at the epidemiological consequences of Brazil versus Colombia. We're not seeing the same magnitude of effects in Colombia that we're seeing in Brazil. So we don't really know, is Zika the only thing that's responsible for these things, or is there some other confounding factor? I think those confounding factors are going to be important. Zika is going to get spread around.
If the virus has mutated, is that mutation something that is now going to continue to be an increasing problem? And how will you know exactly what the genetic sequencing is that might be causing the problem?
We don't know if those mutations are responsible for making it worse. So we have several different viral isolates, the original 1949 isolate from Uganda, and then we have three or four different new isolates that are from the outbreak in Nicaragua, Colombia, and Brazil. We're testing the historical isolate and then with the outbreak isolates can they infect novel mosquito vectors that are present in the United States? Do they transmit or do they not transmit?
Do you think there is a potential that this could spread to the other parts of the world the next few months?
Probably not the next few months, but I would be very interested in seeing what happens next year, especially because now we're looking for it.
What if Florida loses control on the mosquito impact on the population and that we end up with 1,000 cases of microencephaly in Florida and spreading?
Well, I think the governor, Rick Scott, needs to stop saying irresponsible things in the media about how the Zika control area has shrunk. I thought it was incredibly irresponsible.
They're worried about tourism.
Yeah, they're worried about tourism. I think if we have a major outbreak of microencephalic babies being born in Florida from local transmission, they're going to drench the state with insecticide, which is what I would recommend. Do everything you can to avoid being bitten by mosquitoes.
Scarier than I thought, Linda.
It is. And George, at the top of my Earth Files report that goes with this Zika story, there is a new photograph of Manhattan in New York, where they are blowing pesticides everywhere, specifically trying to counteract Zika, which means they are very concerned, while the governor in Florida is trying to reduce the issue, and they shouldn't do that, because on August 8th, the journal Cell Stem Cell published the first study to look at Zika virus infection on adult brains of mice. Using fluorescent biomarker green stains to mark the Zika protein covering, the virus concentrated in neural progenitor cells that are supposed to keep making new brain neurons through life. To lose progenitor cells means reduced brain volume, and that means difficulty remembering and learning. This new research from the Rockefeller University and La Jolla Institute for Allergy and Immunology might give us insight about why there is this huge spike in microcephaly of newborns from mothers infected by the Zika virus, and why some human adults are infected by Zika and then go on to develop Guillain-Barré, muscle weakening, and paralysis. And before the week-long heavy rains of August 9th to 16th flooded some 140,000 homes in metropolitan Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and southwest to Lafayette, U.S. health authorities thought the Zika virus could be contained in Florida. But now all that receding floodwater is the perfect place for mosquitoes to live and bite humans. Anthony Fauci at NIAID, at the infectious disease, said that he wouldn't be surprised if we now see Zika cases in Texas and Louisiana in the standing water. And on top of that, Miami-Dade counties, Wynwood and Miami Beach regions are the first U.S. mainland places to report Zika infections in people who have not traveled. That means local Florida mosquitoes are carrying and transmitting the Zika virus from their bites. Pregnant women in Florida have been advised to not visit the active Zika zone in Miami Beach and to stay indoors as much as possible, George.
I hate mosquitoes. Now I hate them even more, Linda.
Yes. Next up, we're going to be leaving Earth and going to Mars for one of perhaps the most extraordinary insights about our past and our future.
Explosions on Mars, folks. We're going to be back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe, her website, earthfiles.com. In the final hour of our program tonight, we call it Conversations with Linda. We take your phone calls, but you whistleblowers jump on board too, because we get a lot of stories and Linda picks a lot of them up from your calls and your emails. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us. The next story has to do with Mars, and it could happen here as well. Maybe it already has. Linda, what do we have?
Well, in 2015, a newly published book by plasma physicist John Brandenburg, PhD, was entitled, quote, Death on Mars, the Discovery of a Planetary Nuclear Massacre, close quote. And you might say it was his first big pun move on a chessboard with NASA, the government, and other scientists. And now, 63-year-old John Brandenburg, who received his PhD in theoretical plasma physics at the University of California Davis Extension campus at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in Livermore, California, back in 1981, had done his PhD thesis back then about magnetic confinement of plasmas for controlled nuclear fusion. For his book, he analyzed United States 1976 Viking spacecraft data about the Martian atmosphere, as well as two Viking images of the so-called face on Mars that stares upward from a Martian highland in the northern hemisphere called Cydonia Mensa. I have a beautiful photograph of this from that original 1976 transmission. And in spite of NASA JPL's insistence that there is nothing to the face except, quote, a trick of light and shadow, close quote, other scientists have done their own research since the early 1980s and concluded there are eyes, a nose, mouth, teeth, and a horizontally striped headdress that looks very Egyptian. Other scientists who have also studied the face and are convinced it is not natural are Mark Carlotto, PhD of the Analytical Sciences Corporation, electrical engineer Vincent DiPietro, and Gregory Molinar, a computer analyst. They both worked at the Goddard Space Flight Center, and cartographer Errol Torin at the Defense Mapping Agency in Washington, D.C. These scientists have argued that the face and nearby features of a large five-sided pyramid and other structural geometries are the remnants of intelligent inhabitants long ago, not tricks of light and shadow. John Brandenburg dug deeply into original Viking 1976 atmosphere data that showed the amount of xenon-129 on Mars was 2.5 times more abundant than the xenon-129 to xenon-132 ratio here on Earth, where dozens of atomic and hydrogen bombs had been exploded since July 1945, when America's first tested an atomic bomb at the Trinity site in New Mexico's White Sands Proving Ground and Missile Range. Then, in August 1945, the U.S. dropped two atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that ended World War II. After that, there were many atomic and hydrogen bomb tests on Earth until the 1960s. Originally, as Dr. Brandenburg analyzed the isotope data on Mars, he decided the only professionally acceptable way he could report his findings was to hypothesize that on the red planet there could be maybe a natural process that could have produced radioactive materials during meteorite impact explosions. But he discovered that natural nuclear reaction processes do not produce large amounts of xenon-129 isotopes. And over the past year, Dr. Brandenburg has assembled more data to compare the radioactive isotopes in Earth's and Mars atmospheres. And in only 2 weeks, John Brandenburg will be presenting his evolving research in a formal paper at the 2016 Space Conference organized by the American Institute of Astronautics and Aeronautics, September 13 to 16, 2016, in Long Beach, California, at the Long Beach Convention Center. Yeah, there's a hot link at earthfiles.com to this important conference. Other speakers will include the head of NASA and former astronauts, as well as managers from large aerospace companies such as Boeing, and a military manager from Air Force Space Command. This is a significant step for John Brandenburg. The more he researched, the more he discovered that NASA's recorded high levels of radioactive xenon-129 and isotopes of krypton are not produced by nuclear reactors, an important goal of the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963 was to eliminate the release of such radioisotopes in Earth's atmosphere. Further, based on American recorded data of Earth's atmospheric differences before and after July to August 1945, the only explanation for what is observable in the Martian atmosphere and soil would be two large hydrogen bombs exploded in the atmosphere over Cydonia Mensa and Galaxias Chaos, Date Unknown. Recently, I talked with John Brandenburg about the significance of presenting his Martian radiation research at the American Institute of Astronautics and Aeronautics in Long Beach in mid-September. And he joins us now from Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, the fact that the paper got accepted at this conference is quite significant. It means that the scientific community is paying attention to this and has decided that I have raised valid scientific questions, and by saying your paper is accepted means come to our conference and tell us more about this. So I believe there is a shift in opinion in the scientific community that this is an issue which should be talked about, despite the fact that talking about anything involving intelligent activity on Mars was kind of forbidden before. But times have changed. I believe people are now ready to talk about this.
Two blasts in the atmosphere to destroy two populations on Mars, this is a big deal.
Oh, yes. The implications are so enormous and dreadful. In 1945, first atomic bombs were set off. There's a big spike of change in Xenon 129. It's due to nuclear weapons being set off in the atmosphere. That's what makes Xenon 129. The government is very sensitive about this whole Xenon 129 business. Even for our own atmosphere, they don't talk about what it means. Xenon 129, for instance, is not produced in any quantity by a normal nuclear reactor. It's got to be a bomb or a reactor that is making plutonium that makes Xenon 129. And these are inert gases that don't combine with anything. So they just go up in the atmosphere and they stay there. They don't rain out or combine out or anything like that. The other set of inert gases is a gas called krypton. When materials are irradiated with an intense barrage of neutrons, like in a nuclear weapon, you get a characteristic pattern of krypton isotopes. Now we have found that on Mars. So xenon 129 and krypton are like two shoes. The one shoe has dropped. That was the xenon 129. That was graphically apparent. What was harder to find in the literature was krypton, and now that has been found, and it matches Mars. So we have very strong evidence now that something happened on Mars, and the only phenomenon we know that creates these patterns of isotopes is a nuclear weapon. So this krypton is a very important piece of supporting evidence and means that we have a much stronger case than before.
How do you determine that it was two blasts?
Because there are two radioactive scars on Mars, and another piece of evidence we've now found is that large amounts of a type of glass called trinitite. It was first formed at the Trinity nuclear test site in New Mexico, which was the first atomic bomb to go off. It turned the surface of the desert to greenish glass and then etched it with acid from an acid rain that fell after the nuclear weapon went off. And that has been found on Mars at both sites where the radioactive scars are, one in Acidalia Planitia, which is next to Cydonia Mensa. The other one is a place called Utopia Planitia, and that is next to an archaeological site on Mars called Galaxis Chaos. Trinitite has been found at the sites of the radioactivity.
Can you explain to a general audience what there is about the presence of the krypton, the xenon 129, and the trinitite, that this was a hydrogen bomb over the two areas?
My background is in national defense. I am a plasma physicist who trained to work on nuclear fusion energy, which was making a controlled kind of hydrogen bomb reaction. And as part of that training, I had to become cognizant of the basics of nuclear weapon design, because a hydrogen bomb is a controlled release of fusion energy. A lot of the physics, especially for laser pellet fusion, is the same as a hydrogen bomb. So I had to learn a great deal about hydrogen bomb design and construction. My background included a lot of discussions with people about nuclear weapons. I was at Lawrence Livermore National Lab when the neutron bomb was invented. So I've drawn upon my background as a graduate student studying for my PhD in plasma physics to do controlled fusion, to do this Mars analysis. All of the physics is familiar to me. The details of, like, why a specific pattern of xenon isotopes or why a pattern of krypton isotopes would be produced, you have to track that down in the scientific literature. The government does not like talking about these things in a very direct way.
But we need to know in a direct way.
Well, there is going to be a discussion of all of this in the public. I believe it's an idea whose time has come. We have to address the fact that we're not alone in the universe.
Right.
And it's very telling that when we found these things, we reported them to the Pentagon first because we were working for the Department of Defense. So we reported it to the Pentagon. And after 6 months of perhaps internal debates, turned around and said to myself and my colleagues, why don't you publish this? So I interpreted from that that they had decided that this had to come out. Even the government knows that secrets have a half-life. They can only be kept so long. And not only that, secrecy, especially in America, is something that should be used only in cases of extreme national security. It shouldn't be used to hide reality from people.
Right.
The U.S. government at its highest level expected to find a dead civilization on Mars. I've talked to people who used to work at Jet Propulsion Lab during the very early Mars exploration, and they spoke of the fact that armed guards appeared at the photo labs as their spacecraft neared Mars because the management was trying to make sure that no pictures that they hadn't cleared for public release would get out. And the rumors at the Jet Propulsion Lab were the things they were most worried about is finding remains of a dead civilization on Mars. And they did not want that to become public. But they were expecting it, at least as a possibility. And we found it. And now the U.S. government itself has gone back and taken multitudes of new pictures of these sites at Cydonia Mensa and Galaxis Chaos. So they have provided us all the data to make our arguments, and they also released all this nuclear data. So we have evidence on Mars of a big nuclear explosion at two sites. And if you look at the map, those sites are directly upwind of Cydonia Mensa and Galaxis Chaos, meaning they were targeted on those areas to dump their load of fallout at the two sites. The maximum shockwave goes downwind more forcefully. The U.S. government found it in 1976.
With Viking.
With Viking 40 years ago. They've decided that it is time for this to come out. So it's coming out.
One of the first questions I would want to ask the Pentagon officials who have known about this for a long time, who exploded the hydrogen bombs above Cydonia and Chaos on Mars? Who are they? Why did they do this? And who are the million or 2 million bodies that you speculate may be underground dead in Cydonia and in Chaos because of the hydrogen bomb explosions? Who are they?
We're dealing with complexity. We have two hydrogen bombs that went off midair. They did not leave craters. They left an ocean of molten glass on the surface. Why would somebody blow up their own planet? And if they did, one hydrogen bomb was probably as big as the Empire State Building. The other one about probably half as large. Even lifting these things off the surface of Mars to explode them in midair would have been extremely difficult.
So it's likely that it was some other alien intelligence in war with whoever was on Mars.
It appears that an advanced spacefaring species came to Mars and dropped these two weapons from space onto Mars. The weapons were assembled in space, brought to Mars, and dropped. Now, at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, to bring up some very sad history on Earth, there were two nuclear weapons dropped. They were exploded in midair because that maximizes the air shockwave. If you want to destroy civilian structures, you set off the bombs in midair. If you're targeting a military bunker complex, then you set it off on the ground. But if you want to destroy civilian things, you set it off in midair. And that's what we did at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Those bombs left no craters. That's what happened on Mars. So you have an advanced spacefaring species employing massive nuclear weapons in a very ruthless way, and the yield of the weapons was so large. The intention was not only to kill everyone who was living at Cydonia Mensa and the surrounding areas and also at Galaxis Chaos. It was basically to sterilize the planet. It was way overkill. And this means that whoever did this was interested in the complete genocide of Mars. They wanted Mars to be destroyed so that it could never rise again. It would have completely blown the atmosphere off of Mars.
So it would explain the disappearance of all the surface water.
We found what appears to be a global debris pattern stretching all the way around to the far side of the planet, where the shock waves from the explosions ran into each other and deposited a bunch of radioactive debris, what's called the antipode, the opposite side of the planet from the explosion. So this would have completely destroyed Mars' climate. Mars would have been Earth-like before these weapons went off, and would look like it does now afterwards.
This is an attack from outer space on Mars.
From outer space, a third party.
And wow, what a story.
Well, George, I think it is becoming very serious that this is the truth about Mars, and that this may be the way we are finally going to get into the truth about the history on this planet, this solar system, and in the Milky Way galaxy that William Mills Tompkins and Corey Good and other whistleblowers, Anthony Sanchez's colonel, have talked about a war that involved Mars and Earth and all of this. And so one of the interesting things to me is that there's a new book out, and it is by Chris Hardy, and it is called The Wars of the Anunnaki. And at the bottom of my report on Earth Files, I show it, and the subtitle is Nuclear Self-Destruction in Ancient Sumer. And she goes into the cuneiform and the fact that Trinitite, not only at White Sands Missile Range, where we tested the first atomic bomb, July 16, 1945, is there, green crystal glass. I'm showing it in my Earth Files report tonight. But it has been also found on Earth in places like Libya and India and west of Egypt. And those are all areas that she ties to nuclear destruction, Sodom and Gomorrah-like annihilation caused by warring Anunnaki with themselves as a family and with others, and using technology that, quote, scorched with fire and evil wind and killed everything in its path.
Great history there. Up next, an amazing UFO story. We'll be back with more.